You've cracked one open already.
That's my pre-beer.
I was going to say, I'm starting to recognise that slight hazy eye that you have when you drink, Derek.
That, don't be a cheeky shit. That's my first one, and I'm about halfway through. Should we talk about our beers? And we welcome ourselves back to part two.
Yeah.
So welcome to part two.
Hoping to not spill beer all over myself this time.
Well, you've not got the starter tartan tonight either, so...
Oh yeah, I do. It's just like, come down a little bit.
Can you not have a bit more respect for the starter tartan than just have it creased away in the corner of the armchair there?
Well, I've actually got a low alcohol one. just because I went to Aldi and it looked quite nice. It looks a bit like it's wearing a wee jumper, like kind of knitted. It's called the Down Low for the lockdown. And I'm interested
what
to see.
What percent is it?
0.5%. But you know, just to make up for that, I've got a little pineapple, push pineapple.
Oh, nice.
Milkshake IPA.
Milkshake?
Yeah, which is 5%, so it's not that much more. But it's okay, I had some beers before this, so... Don't worry. You've got to make the most of it, because everywhere's about to close on Thursday.
Ah,
so, yeah.
Laurie, what are you rocking? What are you packing?
Please tell me it's
not the alcohol-free.
No, in fact... A BrewDog delivery came the other day. I told you 50% of it was alcohol-free. Not impressed. No, I'm super excited about my beers tonight because normally we would spend quite a bit of time on the islands off the west coast of Scotland over the summer, but for obvious reasons, we've not this year. And like many places in the world, they've been hit pretty bad by COVID, like fragile economies. And relying on tourist trade, so I've taken this little beer journey to the islands, and I do actually order. We order a lot of gin from the Hebridean Islands, but I've now gone to beers. So this is from Colonsay Brewery, which is the smallest island in the world with its own brewery, and I've got some coming from Harris, but they are taking a really long time, so they're Novembers. And then I've also got, I only got it because I like the label. From a brewery in Aberdeen, 6 degrees north. It's called
Stonehaven.
Yeah, Hypocrisy. See, have you drank from them before?
Yes, I'm from Aberdeenshire.
I knew that. Okay. Do you enjoy them?
Yeah. What's the best Hebridean island that you've been to?
Favorite place is North Uist and Anbara.
Cool. I haven't been to them, but I would like to.
Oh, cool.
I've not been to any of the islands yet.
I've been to Tyree. That was cool. Yeah. And then some other ones when I was younger with my family. But yeah, cool. It's a lot further away than it used to be.
So I've got the BrewDog Aldi IPA. I just really liked what was going on with Aldi doing the anti-establishment IPA, and then BrewDog just going, we're not having any of that, but actually it turned into a really cool collaboration between the two of them, so I've got that to try. And then Scottish, you'll enjoy this. I've got a Genius Craft beer, which is also low alcohol, but low alcohol for me is 3%. And Genius Craft beer sponsor a lot of the charity fundraising for Doddy Weir, and of course Scotland won the Doddy Weir Cup at the weekend against Wales, so I thought a bit of a tip of the cap, as it were, to that, and have a Genius beer.
Kind of apt for talking about ontology and epistemology as well. I'm actually quite interested in the Aldi IPA though. Like, have you tasted it yet?
Yeah, it may or may not have been my first ever Aldi IPA, but
because I tried the anti-establishment IPA and did a taste test with the BrewDog, like Punk IPA, and I thought, like a blind one, and I preferred the Aldi one.
Oh,
really?
So I'd like to then also try the BrewDog Aldi IPA and work out if it's any different from their actual Punk IPA, or if they've just put it in a new can.
I don't know. I've got a Hazy Jane in front of me as well. Pre-beers. It doesn't taste like a Hazy Jane. It might It doesn't taste like a punk either. So interesting. Anyway, we've got some reflection to do. Cheers.
Cheers.
So, and I suppose your point to kick us off is a fairly interesting one. Did we answer the question that we asked first off the bat? So one, did we get a plainer account of what ontology and epistemology is and its relevance to sport coaching? I think we did. Do you agree? I think, well, anybody that quotes Wikipedia in their opening gambit around what ontology and epistemology is a hero in my book, for sure.
I bet he marks his students down for doing that. but yeah, I think I learned a much more practical kind of understanding of ontology and epistemology, because previously I'd only understood it really or engaged with it from a research point of view. So I'd never really thought of kind of, putting it so, specifically to practical sports coaching ideas. And I think I learned that from the episode. So I enjoyed it for that reason.
And I think just to bring it back to perhaps one of the questions I asked of Dave, which is not a question we ask in the day job quite a lot, and I'm assuming Laurie asks it of her coaches as well, around what do you believe to be coaching effectiveness, or what do you believe to be coaching, and how then do you know that to be true? So the ontological question being, what do you believe to be coaching, and the epistemological question being, well, how do you know that to be true? So why then do we use terms like ontology and epistemology? And I think we got to the crux of that towards the end around whether those terms were helpful enough around, certainly when Andy was pointed to the secret sauce, and perhaps terms like this being used to, I don't know whether or not it was around power or creating complexity within a system, or the use of language to conflate something as being more complex than it actually is. What are your thoughts, Laurie? Because you've got an interest in language, right?
Oh, I do, definitely. I absolutely do. I think not only, as I've alluded recently to you, not only sort of what's said, but how it's said as well, and the biases that we can have with that. I think just initially, shout out to the guests. They were absolutely brilliant, like so good. And I thoroughly enjoyed listening back to the episode. And yeah, around the point that Andy made, and Vinny kind of connected this as well. So, you know, impression management, and there's just a plethora of information available to us. I think it's quite easy to grasp a surface level understanding of a lot of stuff. And the dangers of that in grabbing that surface level knowledge and not thinking critically about it, and then perhaps using that, you know, for impression management. And I think that just starting from a place of impression management or fear or whatever it is a never a helpful place to start from. And I think that's something that we're quite passionate about on the podcast, just being kind of brutally honest about what we do and don't know. And I loved, you know, on that, I loved Vinny's approach, like the humility and the honesty that he approached the things that he doesn't know about. Like the fact that he was sat in front of that massive bookcase and he was like, if I find a word on the telly that I don't know, I go and look it up. I just thought that was really, really great. And it was good to have that perspective on the podcast from him.
And that notion of taking things on face value without necessarily interrogating why those things may work was a really interesting route, I think, to go down, because we do live in a fairly information-rich world. I think we've pointed to the fact before on Twitter being 140 characters, and we might share some concepts or ways in which we might coach on Twitter, and people might just pick up that misinterpreted or misrepresented in the context of their own coaching environment. So I think it's a really important thing to consider around what Vinny was talking about in terms of personal epistemology. So how do you really know what your stated theories are, what your personal theories are, and what your theories and use are, and is there a degree of congruence, incongruence, or coherence or incoherence between what you say you are as a coach or what you believe coaching to be and what you're actually like as a coach on the ground. And it's really interesting from a coach developer standpoint or a coach educator standpoint to then sit there but not using terms like ontology and epistemology, but asking ontological or epistemological questions of the coaches that you're working with to try and get to the crux of why they are doing things the way they are. And I suppose just we had a quick chat beforehand, Laurie, around Julian's work and climbing the ladder or climbing the mountain towards meta theory and looking back down and understanding why or where some ideas or some perspectives or some approaches to sports coaching may converge rather than diverge, and appreciate sports coaching for that level of complexity, but also that level of simplexity as well, if I can maybe don that term. And I've seen some stuff on Twitter this week around people talking about why am I being forced into, or why am I being told I need to coach one way or the other? And actually being epistemologically literate might mean that you understand why you might pick up or draw upon a number of perspectives, be that ecological, cognitive, or whatever, and be able to coach using those theories, tools, concepts, frameworks, and do so coherently by dipping across or cutting across all of those perspectives relative to the context that you're operating within, the people that you're working with, or what you're trying to achieve out of a given session. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I stole some ideas from Brett Smith, who in turn stole them from Arrow, E-R-A-U-T, in my PhD thesis, arguing for a coaching connoisseur. So like a beer connoisseur, but a connoisseur of coaching, like being able to understand all the different approaches and maybe appreciate some, and you like some more than others because that's your taste, but like if you understand sort of where they've come from and all the things that kind of make it good or not so good in particular contexts, then you can be a bit of a connoisseur and pick what's best for that moment.
Oh, Anna, I really love that, and I'm going to take it and roll with it. So how do we know, how do we support coaches? And this goes back to the point made around mediators. So just to quickly draw upon, you know, what Julian said in the Sports Scotland webinar, you know, if we can climb to that vantage point where we can see some of the theories that sit below it and identify their strengths and weaknesses, which Dave talked about a lot on the podcast, then, you know, then we can get great value from that. So if coaches are connoisseurs, and we relate this to the two-beer minimum, like two episodes in, and I suddenly realised, like, flipping heck, you know, my craft beer choice was limited and poor. And now I'm on this journey, right? And I'm off in the Hebrides trying to find beers. So what is the role of a mediator in supporting coaches to recognise that the craft beers that they might be sampling are relatively limited? And so how do we support them to think critically about their choice of beer, and who does that?
The bartender. Don't know. Could have started by telling him not to drink San Miguel or whatever it was that Phil Llewellyn was drinking.
I'm glad that you called Phil out on that, because that was a hideous contribution to the last two beer minimum.
Please edit that out.
Laurie, the point that you make is a really interesting one, and it's something that I've been debating for a long while, and Anna, you probably have talked about this in your research at times as well, with the role of the coach educator. She gone.
Anna, I have to spend about 90% of the podcast on you because I'm laughing. No, carry on, Derek. I'm muting. Carry on.
But I think I was talking about, going back to your point about mediators, and I'm going to quote Julian on that session they did for us, which I thought was fantastic around politicizing knowledge, and whether we like to think so or not, we may have a personal epistemology as a coach developer, and we may have a way in which we view the world and view sport coaching. We perhaps knowingly or unknowingly impress that upon the coaches that we work with, and do we get to a stage in doing so by replacing one absolute truth for the coach with another, which is my own, rather than operating as the mediator and the assembler of knowledge for the coach relative to the context that they're operating in. And I think we've had a conversation before, Laurie, around the coach developer as brick lore. So the piecer together of things, the piecer together of knowledge that may not necessarily make sense on its own, when put together around a problem, and create something that's novel and new for the coach. And therein, you've got a personal theory, right? Which is similar to what you were talking about, Anna, on Friday on another one of our webinars around shared meaning and then personal meaning. Is that right? Do you want to just go into that?
Yeah, I didn't quite catch exactly all of the things that you were saying because I was just Googling who teaches connoisseurs. and I have just on the Wikipedia page for connoisseurs. But yeah, what would you like to know about the shared meaning / personal meaning?
So what's the role of the mediator in taking something that's shared, i.e. we are replicating a theory, to something that's personal, i.e. I've taken some of that theory and I've synthesized it with what I believe to be coaching, and it's added to my repertoire, as it were, because I've reconciled that, I've worked with that perhaps in a fairly relativistic way, so that it becomes part of my DNA as a coach. Does that make sense? Does that fit with where your work is?
Yeah, my work, it was quite an individual kind of perspective on it, because I was looking at the coaches themselves, like they were central to the research, so like how they understood the kind of learning process and that kind of application of a concept, a shared meaning, to become a personal conception with its own individual meaning. So I guess in their case, the coach developers or mediators could help them, like could help in that, in those situations, by kind of just asking them questions about how could you apply this, and in what situations, like how would you know that it works, and why and how. But I didn't necessarily have data on that, so I don't have data to support that. But yeah, I took kind of more of an individual focus on it, and that's a drawback of a kind of cognitive, social cognitive kind of approach. They can be quite individualistic.
So if as our guests on the podcast discuss quite a bit, I think, in terms of recognising for coaches what theories guide their practice, and then thinking critically about those theories and beliefs, ideas, how do coaches and coach developers, and because I have to really interrogate and recognise my limitations, how do we go about doing that? And how do we support coaches and coach developers to go through that process?
You've got me here, because it goes back to, I think it goes back to agendas. Can you leave your bias at the door? Can you hear me?
I'm just saying, no, you can't leave your bias at the door.
Exactly. You're naturally going to bring some of who you are to the table as a coach developer. But in doing so, you shouldn't necessarily exploit that power that's available to you. Like exploiting that power to impress a viewer, to impress an approach, is, in my view, unethical. From my perspective, our role is perhaps to support people to understand what knowledge is, that it isn't something that's right or wrong, that there are that there isn't one truth, there are many truths. And the world isn't as simple as being black and white. So what works in one context is great, but it might not necessarily work in another context. And what we need to do is to support coaches with the development of knowledges, not just knowledge, and understand the application of that knowledge in certain contexts. Now, when we try and impress our personal views on them, and look, I was guilty of this at the start, and Laurie, you've been in seminars with me, if I think back to the judo session that we were in at Ratho as part of our coach developer training. And at that time I was embroiled in, wrapped up and seduced by the ecological approach, because my lecturer at university, as part of my postgraduate program, said, this is the way. He talked about specifically about information processing and recognition prime decision making, and even classical decision making, as being old schools of thought, And this is the new school of thought that we should really be getting behind, and actually drove us down doing a project for our studies in ecological dynamics and nonlinear pedagogy, because nonlinear pedagogy is the only way. And of course, my reflections of what I saw within the judo context when we were doing that coach developer training was everything was about, you know, an ecological approach. And that was probably reflected in my reflections and me trying to project and impose my opinions on the group. That's wrong. Now, if at that time, if you'd put me in front of a coach, would I have perhaps done the same? Probably yes, because my conception of my understanding of what knowledge is wasn't as where it is now. And I would do a lot more harm than I would do good by taking what I knew and just trying to apply it to everyone's context. So that's where I've got a real problem in certain things that I can see within the system, where there is an approach or a perspective on what sports coaching is, and that being driven fairly hard by people of authority or people with authority. I really struggle with that.
Yeah, Derek, I think that's a really powerful story that you've just told, and I hope the listeners are grateful for the honesty in sharing that. So, and it almost, you know, not only do we need to be or think critically about the theories and ideas that are guiding our practice, but also think critically about the way in which we approach or seek out the knowledge, or not even seek out, but where does that come from? We need to think really critically about where that comes from, who it comes from, what platforms, and seek guidance in doing that.
Yeah, I'm hastened to mention a bullshit filter, but similar to a recent paper that came out, but it is essentially that, isn't it? Like the way in which, and I think we've talked about this before on the echo chambers, and the way in which knowledge is presented for us in 140 characters on Twitter. If we don't consume that critically, then or if we don't put that out in a way where it's like, this is my view and there are many views, versus this is truth, then we're in a real bind there, I think, certainly as developers of coaches, developers of people, where we might have a degree of influence over the way in which they might apply what I've just put out on Twitter, right?
Yeah, but when we were talking about it in the webinar, I was talking about examples from our research where the coach developers said, like, this is just one way. And they've got recordings of them saying that, but the coaches still interpreted it as this is the way that they are telling us we have to do, which they didn't at all. So, yeah, people interpret things in their own ways. So there's other things at work.
And like, we can't detach the knowledge that we have from the context in which it was developed and how your personal biography influenced.
That's the conception bit. So yeah, your individual kind of idiosyncratic knowledge conception is tied to the context in which you've learned it and applied it. So yeah, you can't sort of take it away from that.
Thanks, Anna.
Well, so where are we at to this point in the, and that's been a really interesting discussion.
Yeah, my initial point was around the did you answer your question, was not actually our question, it was your question. So like, your motivation, Derek, for proposing the ontology and epistemology as a topic, did you get that answered, or kind of?
And maybe while he ponders on that, now's the time to open up the second beer if you haven't already. I'm moving from Colonsay to Anna's neck of the woods. I'm up in Aberdeen now.
How was the Colonsay?
Delicious, but I would recommend. That was the IPA. They do one that's got a pig on it. Sorry, that sounds abstract, but it's something to do with a pig, and it's absolutely delicious. I would recommend that one if anyone's buying it. This, yeah.
Pig beer.
A delicious pig.
Who knew you could get beer from a pig? Do you milk it? Like, is that what happens?
No, really. There's something historical about island life as to why it's to do something with a pig. Oh, Jesus. Please cut that.
Yeah, so we've got 8 minutes to 10 PM. So probably going back to Anna's point.
I'm on my non-alcoholic beer.
I know. I'm going down the way as well. I'm going down the ladder to a 3%. How fucking disappointing is that? But lovely beer though. Genius is lovely. So did I answer my point? Did I get what I wanted out of it? So what I wanted to understand, because of the little understanding that I have around ontology and epistemology, did I get a plainer account? Yes. Is there a value in coaches understanding those terms? No. But is there a value in coaches understanding ontological and epistemological questions without necessarily using those terms? Absolutely. Because when you consider what they believe to be coaching effectiveness, where does that come from? Well, it comes from the way in which they view the world, right? And then in developing coaches, we may want them to substantiate that view or justify that view. So if we apply skepticism, not by virtue of negative affirmation, but looking at modest doubt, so that you're asking questions of their perspective so that they can come back and fairly coherently describe why it is that they view the world that way or view the world of coaching that way, then certainly you go a very long way to supporting coaches to develop or be able to articulate their personal theories or their personal epistemology, right? Whereas if you ask a coach the same question, so what do you believe to be coaching effectiveness, and you get a very, very discursive response, you kind of get into a position where this coach doesn't necessarily know what it is that they're talking about. And they've got a very superficial understanding of what coaching practice is, or the practice they are describing that they're doing is. Does that make sense to you? So I suppose exploring those ontological and epistemological questions are useful, but the terms in and of themselves are not.
Yeah, which Finney and Andy, they said the same thing. You know, I mean, it's fascinating because when you zoom in and out, you know, they will impact upon the type of research that is conducted within sports coaching, right?
No, I was just wondering, whether you got your spiel at the start of our podcast sort of sorted. It sounded like you were struggling with some things in your mind.
I was struggling with can you just pull an ontology out of your arse?
You should have said that the first time.
That in essence is what I was struggling with. Like how on earth did ontology suddenly appear within a paper on ecological dynamics in reference to self-regulation, which isn't necessarily something that we traditionally saw within the ecological dynamics framework. We talked about self-organizing, right? I'm just confused by ecological dynamics. It just made me really curious around why that word appeared in that paper. And can we simply create or pull one out of magician's hat? And I don't think we can. Mm. I don't think we can.
Yeah. It is that what the point I was trying to make earlier is that, like, Andy and Dave were both kind of, and Vinny to a certain extent, you know, where are these words appropriate and where are they not? And when you're able to zoom out and see, well, how has, you know, ontology and epistemology impacted the type of research that's conducted and the subsequent outputs of it, and therefore how we might see coaching effectiveness, like, that's fascinating. But for coaches on the ground and coach developers on the ground, is that relevant? And I think that goes back to the point that they all made, and that we need to think critically about the theories that are informing our practice. But, you know, just a nod to Julian's book, which I know Andy gave, that really broadened my outlook. You know, and Andy talked about giving a complex paper to a first year, is it appropriate or is it not? And so when I first visited Julian's book, I had that similar feeling of, okay, this is complex, but I'm thirsty to try and make sense of it. Like, I really want to try and get to grips with it. And I've revisited it so many times. And, you know, as he discusses in the book, you know, research over past years have looked at coaching as behaviours, coaching as cognition, coaching as social and complexity, and tried to find the similarities in those as opposed to the differences. And then as a coach developer, it has helped me, and I'm really only still trying to get to grips with the book, but it has helped me consider, well, you know, when I'm viewing coaching, what do I lean more towards? What is my dominant lens? What do I prioritise? And what do I need to better understand? And therefore, what are my biases and how might that impact my practice as a coach developer? So, yeah, it's I just highly recommend it.
Sounds like you've got a much better handle on the book than I do. I've just been dipping in and out of it as and when I need to relative to work that I'm doing, and I've not necessarily invested the same level of time for the same motivations as you have. But every time I do go into the book, there's always something to be learned. I have found Julian really generous with his time, and we're aware that he's done a webinar for me recently, and I just thought he was fantastic and really humble with the way in which he presented his work within that as well. And it's probably keen to note that his beef was never around coaching practice but coaching research within his work.
It's quite interesting that people tend to have this, they're like, oh, coaching research and coaching practice, and they're quite separate. And Laurie, you just mentioned like coaches on the ground, but a lot of people that research sport coaching are interested in sport coaching because they are coaches. So it's sometimes more difficult. Just kind of putting people in boxes, and people are like, oh, you're an academic. Well, yeah, but I am also a coach.
Thanks for pulling me up on that, Anna. And I think that's like one of the most awesome things about having you on this pod, in that you've been athlete, coach developer and researcher. And they discuss, you know, how do we bridge that gap between theory and practice? And you see people like, you know, Dave brought up Bob Muir. Well, he's a researcher, what would you call it, like scientist practitioner, and that he's bringing the most current research to his practice and simplifying really complex things for coaches. And you're obviously one of them as well. And then we've got these emergent coach developers that are trying to, like Derek and I, and do what we can within the area, you know, within academia, and try and bring that to our practice. But it's not always easy.
Yeah. I think that's another reflection I had, and I had a follow-up conversation with Simon Phelan, who was a guest in the first episode, and we talk about the games that we have to play, the hoops that we need to jump through, and perhaps one of the reasons why it's so difficult to bridge the gap between academia and practice is the way in which papers are written and who they're written for. They're not necessarily always written for practice. They're written for the reviewer. How often is the reviewer as close to practice perhaps as the researcher is? And it does appear to be that political game that people play to try and get things published. Rightly or wrongly, they need to write or construct their argument in a certain way that is unhelpful for practitioners on the ground. And I know Pete Alushonga was talking about, I think they put out a tweet through the 80% Mental podcast around, would you value a 5-minute snippet of what the researcher really meant when they wrote that paper? And I think 99.99999% recurring said absolutely yes. So there is an argument perhaps for, yes, academics having to play the game, but in the back of their mind understanding how they're going to construct their research in a way in which that is digestible by practitioners. But again, it goes back to your point, Laurie, is that the role of the academic or is that the role of the mediator? So organizations like UK Coaching, people like us, sports governing bodies, Sport Scotland, EIS, SIS, our role is to probably interpret that and present that in a way that is both coherent and digestible for the coaches that we work with. But again, not offering one perspective over the other, but offering one perspective with the other, which I think is a pretty crucial endeavour for us as developers of coaches.
Yeah, nice point, Derek. Dave said that, didn't he? All theories are wrong. All theories are wrong, and there's better and worse theories.
So should coach developers, oh, this non-alcoholic beer has really hit me, should coach developers be teaching coaches about ontology and epistemology, not necessarily using those words, but like what those things are, like from the start, so that they can kind of start to do that job more themselves, like make sense of the information that they're getting and make judgments over what's useful to them or not.
I can't ever see those words being in my
vocab.
No, in my vocab as a coach developer.
You can't even say the word vocabulary.
Yeah, exactly, right. And in fact, my challenge at the end of this podcast is going to be, after 2 beers, can we all spell those 2 words?
Fun challenge.
Great question, Anna. I can't ever see them being in my vocab, given that they're only recently in my vocab. But what their influence on research and coaches and athletes is huge. So I think I feel a responsibility to better understand them.
I kind of had this conversation with Richard Cheatham on Phil Llewellyn's podcast, actually, last week or 2 weeks ago. And Cheats talked about coaching philosophy, and I talked about my experience going through, say, level 1, 2, 3, 4. And the things that I learned at level 4 would have been really helpful if I learned in part at level 1 or level 2. But I think taxonomically, so the way in which we construct knowledge for coaches through the coach education frameworks currently is unhelpful, because we load up really complex concepts, theories, frameworks at level 4, when we should be dialing them down to a degree and introducing them at level 2. So this notion of a spiral curriculum, where building upon what's been learned before and building towards what we need to succeed as a coach in the future. So would we use terms like ontology and epistemology? Again, absolutely not. But would we be asking ontological and epistemological questions through the development of coaches all the way through? Then absolutely. Getting somebody to question really early on, well, what do you believe to be coaching practice, might be an unsettling experience for a coach at the start, but it would be a very useful endeavor later on in their career. Unsettling coaches in a really supporting way, not necessarily always challenging, is fairly useful when it comes to developing more rounded coaches who can appreciate knowledge for what it is, and not something that's absolute.
Yeah, you could certainly ask new coaches what they think coaching is.
And there you go, there's an ontological question, which is really simple, that you could ask anybody who's coaching young kids to professional sport. They're going to come up with different answers, but you're still asking the same type of question.
Yeah, followed by, why do you think that? How do you know that?
Lovely, Anna. What was the point that Andy made that was... it was really important. What did he say? The greater the consequence, or what was it? The greater the consequence, the more time the more consideration you should give over ontological and epistemological considerations, right? Because, and he gave that lovely example about of Coach Ed.
No, I know what you're saying, and that. If we consider things ontologically and epistemologically earlier on in the process of developing something that, such as coach education, then we wouldn't be in the position when we're in just now, which is a very behaviorist, competency-based framework that was adopted from industry and Taylorism, so Abergerianism. This is what it goes back to Julian's notions around normative prescriptions of what coaching ought to be. Versus what coaching can be relative to the context that the coaches are operating in. I'm guessing that's where you were going with that, Laurie.
Yes, exactly. Thank you.
Or Chris Cushion's models of and models for.
Ooh. I think Chris also says spitting in soup quite a lot as well, which I quite enjoy.
Yeah.
Is it worth elaborating on that, Anna, for the podcast?
It's just a different way of saying the same thing that Derek just said, but I think Cushion might have said it before. because he's been around for longer. I don't know. Yeah.
I thought you were about to say cushion says it better.
Possibly.
Definitely.
Models for coaching tend to kind of proliferate. I knew I wasn't going to be able to say that.
Proliferate.
Yes. Models for coaching tend to proliferate because they're sort of idealistic representations of what we should be doing, whereas models of are based on data, and they're actually what is happening rather than idealistic representations like what should you be doing.
Should we wrap it up with perhaps one final thought, one lesson or nugget or learning or takeaway?
Learning is not a noun.
So grimacing.
It's you know fine. What? My biggest lesson here is one of gratitude to Derek actually for setting up this pod, and just recognizing that big subject that you wanted to discuss and wrestle with over beers, and a few great guests, and I'm delighted you did. I've loved it. Totally loved it.
Yeah, I still probably sound like I don't know what I'm on about, and I probably still don't know what I'm on about. But
I think people would be pretty judgmental if we finished a podcast, two podcasts, and suggested that we're comfortable with epistemology and ontology. we're a bit more comfortable.
Yeah. I'm happy being the least intelligent person in the room.
We're not in a room.
We're in a virtual room, you shite bag. Cheers to that, Anna. You've just completely messed up. I wonder if Laurie wants to do just a brief intro to the next episode.
Okay, so episode 3 is going to be on skill acquisition from the perspective of 3 coaches operating in freestyle action sports.